Hello and welcome to another episode of Max Planck Florida's Neurotransmissions Podcast. I'm Joe Schumacher and with me is...
Misha Smirnov.
PhD.
PhD. And we have a super special episode. You know, a lot of the time, you know, we get a lot of fan mail. And, you know, I always hear, you know, Misha, this is, you know, you got this amazing show.
This is the greatest thing I've ever heard.
This is the greatest thing I've ever heard.
How are we ever going to top that?
You know, you have a PhD. You know all this science.
Everyone loves you.
Everybody loves you.
You're universally respected. You're an excellent father.
You know, and all before the age of 20. You know, incredible. But there is one thing that I don't have.
What's that?
A Nobel Prize.
Oh, yeah. You don't have a Nobel Prize.
I don't. But that is the only thing that sets me apart from the person we are talking to today.
It's actually not true. He's an extremely accomplished person that has done more than you and I will probably ever do in our lives combined.
I guess that's true.
This is Edvard Moser. He's a Norwegian psychologist and neuroscientist. In 2014, he shared the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine with Maybrit Moser and their mentor, John O'Keefe, for uncovering different types of cells in the hippocampus that basically make up our system for encoding where we are in the world, sort of our place in the environment. They've done this with using classical neuroscience techniques. And the discoveries that they've made are not just important for understanding how the hippocampus works, but really for understanding how neural circuits in general build up interesting representations of the world. So we're going to hear a lot about his career, how he got interested in science to begin with, how he got interested in studying the hippocampus, what's unique about the hippocampus, what properties do these circuits share with the rest of the brain, and it's a wide ranging and fascinating conversation. I think, you know, one of the things that really has always sort of struck me about our place system in our brain is that, you know, it's thought to do so many different things. Like hippocampal place cells encode where an animal is in an environment, for instance. But we also hear about interesting case studies like HM, who his bilateral hippocampal lesions and then had a serious form of amnesia for the rest of his life. So it also seems to be involved in episodic memory. So how are these sort of vastly different functions integrated on some fundamental level? I think that's something that Dr. Moser shares with us today. He's a recipient of not just a Nobel Prize, but way too many honors and acclaims to mention here. He's also a member of the Royal Norwegian Society of Science and Letters, the Norwegian Academy of Science and Letters, Norwegian Academy of Technological Sciences. He has lots of professorships and affiliations that we'll talk about in the episode. But all in all, this was a really fascinating conversation. And Ben is here. He's not here with us right now, but he's no longer here with us. Yeah, he's not dead. He's not in the room.
I mean,
he's
in our hearts.
He's in our hearts, and so you'll hear Ben on this interview too. So let's take a listen. Let's talk to Dr. Moser. So today we're joined by Dr. Edvard Moser. He's the founding director of the Kavli Institute for Systems Neuroscience and the co-director of the Center for Neural Computation at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Dr. Moser, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So I guess one of the first questions I have is, how does a young boy from a rural island in Norway go on to become a neuroscientist? What was your sort of first foray into science, or how did you get interested in it as a young child?
Well, I was interested in knowledge. I wanted to know how everything about science, any field really. I had a mother who fed me with books, all kinds of science books. So that was my entry to science. I I didn't know any scientists. It was a rural area, as you mentioned, and I didn't. I mean, school was okay, but it wasn't until I got to high school that I really got the input and the stimulation that I wanted. So I was quite self-going for quite a number of years. But I always, from the beginning, knew that I wanted to do research, that I wanted to become a scientist, although I didn't really know what a scientist was like. It's just something I read about in books. I liked a broad range of sciences, so it was difficult to choose. But when I got to university, then I finally ended up with psychology. And then in psychology is a very broad subject, so some things were interesting, but many things were not so interesting. And I was especially interested in the neural basis of behavior, not a topic that was well covered at that time. But then finally we got contacts then that made it possible to pursue a path and start thinking about a PhD in that field.
So what was it about psychology initially as opposed to, you know, organic chemistry or whatever? Was it something about studying the mind or, like, human behavior?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was somewhat random. So, I mean, I began actually with, I considered several options. So nuclear physics was one, and I wanted to do organic chemistry. But I think the questions weren't big enough. So, I mean, questions that I met in psychology, how can we explain human behavior? They found them quite fundamental and difficult and challenging. So I really wanted to work on them. So that was perhaps the main reason for beginning with psychology.
And then maybe you could sort of trace your trajectory a little bit from this early interest in the neural basis of psychological phenomena to entorhinal cortex. So we've talked about hippocampus on this show once before, I think, only, and it was in the context of epilepsy and seizures. And what is it about this part of the brain that struck you as very important or very interesting?
Well, there are several things, but one obvious thing is that hippocampus is real cortex. It's far, far into the brain, far away from any of the senses or any of the motor systems. And as a psychologist, I really wanted to understand the most complex behaviors, which, rely heavily on the cortex. The hippocampus is the part of the cortex that is best understood in the sense that it has a very clear structure. It actually even consists of a more or less unidirectional loop, so that it's quite easy to pick up and interpret signals, neural signals from that structure. And then at the same time, this damages in the hippocampus are known to lead to severe deficits in memory particularly, but also in the sense of location. So that there was, when I started, there was already an established link between this part of the brain and some behaviors like memory and like the ability to perceive space. So this link made it then a quite attractive structure to investigate, together with the fact that it is so orderly organized that you actually can study it with techniques that were available at that time.
So can you tell us a little bit about your research coming into now? I mean, what kinds of techniques have you been able to work yourself into that has helped you gain knowledge of how the hippocampus actually works?
Yeah, so perhaps the most important technique is a technique where you record neural signals from individual cells. So if you have small sensors or electrodes that are so thin that they actually pick up can pick up electrical signals from individual cells, then you have a way to relate the activity of those individual cells to what the animal is actually doing. So all of this work is being done in rats or mice, and we were then able to test these animals while they were doing things in laboratory tasks, and at the same time we could record the activity of a particular individual neurons in the hippocampus, and then we could relate the two, and then saw that these neurons actually fired or were active in a way that suggested that these rats had an internal map of the space.
So, backing up just one thought I had was, you mentioned that people who've had deficits in the hippocampus have had have demonstrated problems with memory. There's the famous case of HM, who had a severe form of amnesia after having was it a bilateral resection of his hippocampus?
What's HM's name, by the way, now?
We know that. I don't know. We'll insert it here. but he's one of the most valuable case studies, I think, in the history of neuroscience. And also this idea of spatial representation, navigation. What is it about this this circuit that, because in my mind, you know, as a layperson, these seem like kind of two separate categories of you know, the human mind. One is like remembering what's on the grocery list, and one is, you know, knowing how to move around in a room or something like that. So how do these two things get implemented in the same part of the brain?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. Actually, for quite a number of years, it was a controversy whether the hippocampus was a structure for memory or whether it was a structure for an internal map of space. And some people thought it was a memory structure, some people thought it was a space structure, and very few consider that it actually could do both. So today, I think most people see the hippocampus as actually doing both. So we know that hippocampal cells, almost all hippocampal cells, respond to the location of the animal or the subject, even if it's also in humans. So cells are location responsive, but at the same time, these cells are also encoding memories of what's going on. And I don't think these two are incompatible, because the hippocampus may encode a map of space, so every cell may tell you or tell the rest of the brain where you are at any given time. But then at the same time, on top of that activity, you may also encode the particular events that take place on those locations. So I think in a way you can see the hippocampus as a spatial framework, and on top of that spatial framework, then the brain encodes experience. And I think this is exactly what we call episodic memory, because if you think about episodic memories, they all have a spatial component. They all indicate, whether you intend it or not, when you recall an event, a single event, it is always taking place at some location. You always remember that location, and then you remember what happened at that location. And I think this reflects what the hippocampus is doing. So it is expressing a map of space, and on top of that map of space, it also stores memories of what actually goes on.
So this is sort of an example of how Marcel Proust starts off his famous saga of books, where the narrator smells like a Madeleine cookie and remembers like everything about his childhood suddenly. So how do memories get triggered? How does somebody smell a cookie and remember where they were in their childhood. Are there integration of sensory signals or?
No, so what we believe is that these memories are stored as patterns of activity among large numbers of cells in the hippocampus or in the rest of the cortex. And when you recall an event, then that usually starts with a trigger, as you say, and that trigger may activate a small part of that original cell network. But then because when you encoded this cell network when you encoded the event into your memory, then what happened is that those participating cells were strengthened among each other so that the connections between them were strengthened. Then when you recall it later and you maybe just trigger a small part of it, perhaps, for example, by providing an odor, which was a part of the experience, then those strengthened connections cause the whole thing to come up, the whole network to become activated, and you remember not only the odor, but also the rest of the experience.
So kind of like through the reactivation of this pattern of activity, you're resuscitating like something that happened in the past, essentially. It's sort of a replay of...
More or less like a replay, yes. Okay.
So I was just curious about, since you started off this conversation talking about the link between memory and space. So what happens in, let's say, blind people or blind mice where your capacity for vision is decremented and then presumably you either form a different sort of spatial memory or your spatial memory is somehow different than what you can encode with knowing where you are by where you see. Obviously, if you still have your vestibular system intact, then you get some internal signals, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, these memories aren't heavily dependent on vision because you can... a memory of a location in space and also a memory of what takes place there can happen via a number of senses. And especially for navigation, or for finding your way... you rely heavily on both vestibular inputs and also proprioceptive inputs. So the signals from the body, from your own movement in space, are already by themselves extremely important for telling the brain how much you have moved from one place to another and what direction. So you can actually use those movement signals to construct a representation of your location in space. But the problem with just using your own movement to calculate where you are is that it's inaccurate and accumulates error. So that vision is really good for correcting the error all the time. And if you don't have vision, you may not be able to do that. However, I mean, you can correct in other ways. You can use sounds, or you can use tactile inputs when you bump into a wall or whatever. So that, and you can use odors, especially if you're a rat. So, I think the system is made in such a way that you don't really need visual input. It's very useful and it corrects errors, but it's not absolutely necessary. Cool. So it takes place in the same way, more or less, mm-hmm. I would say.
So there's sort of like a foundation. A specific sensory input or a major component that you can rely on, but it could be the system's designed to use whatever is available.
Exactly.
It can rely on vision if vision is there, or in combination with everything else or otherwise. So.
Exactly. It's very robust. And vision, of course, has the advantage that it's very accurate, unlike mm-hmm. odors, for example, which are spatially not so accurate.
So I want to ask a question again about... you were talking about how memories are stored as specific patterns of activation. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of listeners would be interested to know, you know, we always kind of talk about what is really a memory in the biological sense. To me, that's also one of the most appealing things in neuroscience, because when I was also thinking about majoring in psychology, I wanted to know a little more detail about what is the actual mechanism that describes this event. So when we talk about a pattern of activation, are we talking about a collection of cells that will fire together, or are we talking about a collection of cells that will fire together in a really specific frequency? Are we talking about specific molecular mechanisms in each of these cells? Can there be a cluster of cells that are exactly the same for two different memories? I mean, what is the detail that we have to look into?
Well, I have to then say that we don't know so much about that yet, because it's only now that it's possible to begin to study these clusters of active cells while memories are being formed or retrieved. But what we do believe quite strongly, most neuroscientists, is that a memory consists of cells that are connected together, and that those connections are strengthened while you encode the memory into the brain, and that there is a process called long-term potentiation involved, and that's a mechanism that cells use to strengthen their connections. It was actually discovered more than 40 years ago, but people haven't really, until now, been able to relate it specifically to memories. But if this process is taking place when cells are connected during memory formation, then we know actually quite a lot about the molecular mechanisms. And for example, it's known that a particular type of glutamate receptor, so glutamate is a neurotransmitter and a type of receptor that the brain uses, is called NMDA receptor. And those receptors are quite special, because those receptors allow calcium to enter into the cell. And that happens only when cells on the on one side of the connection and cells on the other side of the connection are simultaneously active. So it's a way for the brain to detect coincidence when things happen simultaneously. And in that way, the brain actually can store events, experiences. Many things that happen together are then brought together and then stored as a memory. So this is challenging to explain within the time we have now, but I think we can say that we at least we have models of what molecular mechanisms underlie this formation of cluster formations. We have molecular models that of how cells are connected together when a memory is stored, and it's not entirely clear yet whether these models are true, but it's a lot of evidence pointing in that direction.
I've had this question for a very long time relating to this.
We can
delete it later, but I feel like I want to ask. So, yeah. So in thinking about LTP and certain connections being changed so they're stronger or weaker, and thinking about how you might form a memory through the combination of many different signals, it always occurs to me that there's this inherent problem where there's a finite number of connections a cell can have. And if a cell is not using a particular connection, we might say that it doesn't exist. And so, but then how can we form memories with any combination of any stimuli? It almost seems that either new connections have to be formed a lot, or really weak connections have to always persist throughout our lifetime, and our brain has to sort of know about the mind-numbingly large probabilistic combinations of things that we could experience in the world to be able to have the capacity to store any combination of those things. Mm. And I've always been fascinated by this idea, or whether it's a problem at all, in trying to understand how activating specific connections and changing specific connections leads to memories.
Mm. Well, that's a very good question. I think it's important to remember that at least in the hippocampus, when you're so deep in the brain, there is not any input any longer corresponding to a particular sensory stimulation. So it's not one input that is the odor, another input is the sound, and so on. Not one input that is the table, and another one is the window, and another one is the door. So actually how it happens, that is not so easy to tell. But what we know about the networks in the hippocampus, and actually in many, many places of the cortex, is that they are heavily interconnected, so that the opportunities for cells that express slightly different types of information to actually be connected, either directly or through some other cell indirectly, which is also good, those probabilities are very, very high. So I think you achieve the associativity you need in any case. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a problem, really.
So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about some of the particular cells that are embedded in these hippocampal networks from a functional standpoint. Mm-hmm. So one of your great discoveries with your colleagues was finding this class of cell called a grid cell. Mm-hmm. There are other cells called place cells. Maybe for some of our listeners and me, who is not a hippocampus expert, you could sort of tell us a little bit about these different types of cells. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how they work together to help us form a spatial map.
Perhaps I can begin historically. So in the 1970s, John O'Keefe discovered the place cell. So that was the first cell to be discovered. And this was in the hippocampus proper. So he found cells that were active when a rat was walking around in a box or in a maze. And each cell fired only at a particular location in this environment. So because it fired only at one place, more or less at one place, you could then call them place cells. Different cells fired in different locations, so that together these cells seem to cover all of the space and in some way then provided an internal map of the rat's position. So wherever the rat was, there was a unique combination of active cells. So then, this was 1970s, and then for a long, long time, people really didn't understand how these cells came about. Where did they get their input from? And were they alone? How did they operate? Because this was more or less in the middle of the brain, far away from the sensory receptors. So one didn't really understand how the signal was generated.
It's a pretty complex receptive field. It requires a lot of different types of information, it seems.
Yes. So we really followed up on that. And then more than 30 years later, actually, then we started recording in a different part of the brain. It's still very close to the hippocampus, but slightly outside, called entorhinal cortex, which is a major input structure to the hippocampus. And what we found there is first that those cells also had spatial firing fields. That means that they fired only in particular locations. But most of the cells fired in many locations, many discrete locations. And then we found that those discrete locations were actually not scattered randomly at all. They formed a triangular, or if you want, a hexagonal pattern that covered the entire space that the rat or the mouse was walking in. So this hexagonal pattern of firing areas that looked like a grid, and for that reason we called the cells grid cells. So what they contain is a metric of space. They tell about distances and directions. It's more or less like an internal coordinate system, which is something that the place cells didn't have. So it was a second component of the rat's internal map. And then a year later, we then saw that these cells coexisted with a third type of cell, which had been known to exist for a while, but in different brain areas. And those were the so-called head direction cells, cells that fire only when the rat's head is pointing in a certain direction. So it's more or less like a compass. They tell about the direction. And just 2 years later, we found yet another type of cell, which we called border cells. So these border cells that fire only when the rat is along the local borders of the environment, along a wall or along an edge of a table. And all of these, and then there's yet another one, which we found only a year ago, namely the speed cell. So these cells express how fast the rat is walking or running in the environment. So the faster the rat was running, the faster is the cell firing. So then we have multiple types of cells, and all are, except for the place cells, which are in the hippocampus proper, the others are in the entorhinal cortex. They are intermingled, and obviously part of a network where grid cells speak to border cells and vice versa, and these all speak to the head direction cells and to speed cells. So, of course, one of the interesting questions to work on now is to find out how do these cells actually work together to create an internal sense of where you are.
So do these different types of cells have different molecular identities or genetic identities, or are they essentially the same type of cell, but because of how they're situated in a network, they have different functional properties?
No, that's one of the key questions. So it's not as simple. It's not so as simple that that grid cells are one type of cell and border cells are another, and so on. It seems like, at least for the main classes of cells, which are called stellate cells and pyramidal cells, can be at least both grid cells and border cells. Perhaps the speed cells are more interneurons, but it seems there's not a one-to-one match between a morphological cell type and functional cell type. I think what we need to look at is what genes are expressed, maybe what are the ion channels or what other molecules exist in those cells that are grid cells that don't exist in those that are border cells, for example. And that is a more complicated question. It will take a while to find that out, but I'm sure that maybe within next 5-10 years, one will find that they actually have different genetic identities.
I guess another question I have is, I know that in a lot of, there are a lot of behavioral tests you can do with rodents to assess how they navigate an environment, and there's certain models of like stress that look at how much time does an animal spend next to a wall versus out in an open arena. Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence to suggest that perturbations of one of these cell types, like maybe a stressed animal has fewer border cells or something like that? Maybe that's a little bit oversimplified, but if you perturb one class of cell or a group of these cells, does it have any impacts on the animal's behavior?
Yeah, perturbing one type of cell and not the other, that's the type of experiment we would like to do. But that requires that we find the identity of each of the cells. But if we find the genetic identity, I mean, which genes are expressed in one cell and not the other, then it is also possible to turn each of them on or off, and then see what is the impact both for the other types of cells, how they respond, and also for the behavior. So, for example, if you turn off one type of cell, does that, the grid cell, for example, does that mean that the animal will not really be able to measure distances and directions? Or if you turn off the border cells, will it not be able to relate it to the external surroundings? But we are not there yet. What we do know is that this entire area, namely the entorhinal cortex, is necessary for animals to find their way, and also for humans. Without an intact entorhinal cortex, you're lost. And that is actually also expressed in humans, because the first area of the brain that is usually damaged during Alzheimer's disease is the entorhinal cortex. So it's a very early factor in that disease. And as we all know, with Alzheimer's disease, one of the first symptoms is the loss of spatial orientation. You can't find your way. So it goes along with this damage to the entorhinal cortex and presumably the whole spatial network. But it's indirect, so if we want to understand exactly what each type of cell does, we really need to find their genetic identities so that we can manipulate them individually?
I'm always hesitant of asking questions in these sorts of topics because everything I think of always ends up being philosophical or stupidly sci-fi. But I'm going to go with it anyway. Mm-hmm. At least to kind of keep it based in the real world, I guess. What do you see as sort of the nearby future of the science? What kind of applications are we going to have once we discover more and more about, let's say, the genetic identity of place cells? And, you know, are we going to be able to develop cures for... certainly there's a big industry in trying to develop treatments and cures for Alzheimer's, but, you know, when it comes to actually manipulating memory, whether location memory or not, you know, either... if it's wiping away PTSD in soldiers or all the way into implanting knowledge of certain kinds of things. I mean, how far away are we from that?
Well, I think that is still quite far away because memories consist of groups of cells that are distributed over very large areas, both within the hippocampus and the surrounding areas, but even the rest of the brain. Often not so many cells, but they're far away from each other. And to really know which cells are involved and which are not, and even try to reproduce that by sort of stimulating cells in the brain is I can't even think how you would do it at this time, even if you had the knowledge about every single cell. So I think the complexity of memories and their... that dynamic nature and the fact that it's never done in the same way in any situation. Each memory, each new memory you encode has a unique signature. That makes it actually extremely difficult to try to implement it artificially. But of course we can learn from the way the brain produces memories, and that can be used to design, for example, computers or robots that use the same mechanism to store memories and to use them, to retrieve them, and use them for behavior in a much more intelligent way than computers do today.
I think one of the other really cool things about entorhinal cortex, hippocampus, these really well-defined circuits, is that the more you find out about how information is processed and represented in them, you learn a little bit more about neural systems in general. So you learn how circuits work, how they form, how maybe there are broader principles.
Absolutely.
I
definitely agree. So this is a major motivation for the work we are doing. So it's not only about understanding how we produce internal maps and how we find our way. So that's a sub-goal, but the real goal is just to understand how the cortex works. What are the principles for information processing in the brain? And for that, we are using the spatial system because it is, after all, relatively simple. It's a part of the brain that at least is better characterized than most other parts of cortex in the mammalian brain. And also the spatial signals are quite easy to measure. I mean, you get signals or outputs like place, those are place cells and grid cells, which are so clear and so easy to recognize that you can tell immediately that this is a place cell or a grid cell. It's not embedded within a lot of noise from other types of functions. So that makes it much easier to study and then understand how it works. And quite often, the brain is conservative, is using the same principles for different functions, so that if we understand one system very well, then we may learn that at least many of those tricks are used also in different parts of the brain for different purposes.
Cool. So we're about out of time. I thought maybe one last question I'd be really interested to hear about was the first time you and your colleagues observed a grid cell, what that experience was like. Did you think it was a mistake maybe? Like maybe we just like are recording from a bunch of different place cells or maybe somebody got something wrong in the analysis or, yeah, what was that that discovery like?
Sure. Well, first of all, it was a quite slow discovery. So because the first thing we noticed is that entorhinal cells have spatial activity. So they fire in certain locations and that those are quite regular. But we didn't quite understand that regularity for a while. So we thought it was very regular. We thought we saw some sort of triangular structure, but it was only when we really expanded the environment that it became very clear. But when we then, when it then was clear that there was such a triangular or hexagonal structure, it was so regular that it raised doubts. And one of the first things that came to my mind was, of course, that this was a technical artifact or something with the recording system that I couldn't explain. But of course, we had to do all of these controls. It soon became clear that it was real, but... of course, the first thing you wonder when you get such a nice and clear result is that it's a pure artifact.
Right. Yeah, it takes a long time for you to actually believe your own work before you can even show it with other people. That's really cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a real treat.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to you, too. Yeah.
Thank you so much to Dr. Moser for sitting down with us and explaining... all of that to us, because it was super complicated, but very insightful.
Yeah, none of us are, hippocampal entorhinal cortex people, so...
I guess I kind of...
Are you?
Yeah.
I've
pivoted.
I don't know what you do, actually.
You know? What do I do?
You make computers.
Yeah.
Go, right.
But, it's a hippocampal lab.
Yeah, sure. Yes, thank you so much to Dr. Moser. It was a real treat, and... thank you to our scientific communication department for organizing this for us, and to IT department for putting up the podcast equipment for production purposes and stuff.
Thank you for to the Institute for sponsoring this whole venture.
Yeah, and stay tuned for more great episodes. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and Google Play. As always, follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Neuropodcast. Misha is... at Salad Zombie, and I'm at JW Science. And until next time,
goodbye.